Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In her new book, Plan B, Further Thoughts on Faith, the unclassifiable novelist and essayist Anne Lamott once again tells it like she sees it. This dreadlocked 50-something Christian hellraiser is high on Jesus and furious with much of what goes on in the world. In her toughest moments, she finds humor, humanity, and hope, but don't get her started on George Bush. Tonight on Point, Anne Lamott and Plan B. But first, we begin tonight in Detroit, where the giant car makers, General Motors and Ford, today saw their debt rating slashed to junk status. The news was not unexpected, but caused shivers anyway. Shares of each company dropped about 5%. Ford and GM officials moved quickly to defend their company's outlooks. Neil Beaudet covers the automakers for the Wall Street Journal. He joins me now from Detroit. Neil, thanks for being with us tonight.
Pleasure to be here.
So we've been hearing the shaking and quaking over there. Here comes junk status. Why?
Well, because both companies are heavily dependent on large SUVs for a huge chunk of their profits, and that segment is declining in sales. And as Standard & Poor's pointed out today, much of their strategy is dependent on these SUVs, and they haven't moved fast enough to correct many of their other problems, such as high pension costs and healthcare costs.
We've heard talk in recent months of even bankruptcy for General Motors, a kind of unthinkable thought. Does this make it harder for GM, for Ford, for that matter, to dig out of the troubles they're in?
Yes, it does. It makes it more expensive for them to borrow money. When they issue bonds, they'll now have to pay a higher interest rate, and when you're borrowing billions of dollars to fund the development of cars, even a small increase in your interest rate costs you a lot of money, and it means that their Japanese competitors, especially like Toyota and Honda, are more competitive and have a lower cost of borrowing money. So, yeah, it does hurt their ability to compete.
So what's the strategy? How do they get out of the hole?
That's the magic question. Part of the problem is that they're locked into a union contract, so reducing health care costs would be mean they would have to open up their current contract. Getting rid of a brand, such as shutting down Buick for GM or shutting down Pontiac, they would have to pay the existing dealers a lot of money to get out of these franchise contracts. When GM shut down Oldsmobile a few years ago, it cost them more than $1 billion to do that. Closing plants, well, that would be one thing they could do if they could get the union to agree. But by doing that, that means they would sell fewer cars, have less revenue, and therefore less money to pay the health care costs of their existing employees and the thousands of retirees whose health care tabs they also pick up.
So, Neil,
that's not an obvious answer.
Is not obvious. What about just starting to produce cars that people really want to buy, cars that are more energy efficient in this period of high gas prices, maybe even hybrids, getting out of the SUV game? Can they do it? Is it possible?
Sure. Look at Chrysler. Chrysler had some of the same problems that GM and Ford have in terms of these union contracts and health care and pension obligations, not to the same extent, but they have done a very good job on developing cars that people are willing to pay full price for. Most of the GM vehicles, or many GM vehicles, you can't sell them unless you give buyers a big discount, and that's been the one mistake that you can say GM had full control over, or Ford had full control over, is that they just haven't developed cars that people get really excited about, with few exceptions. Cadillac has done very well, the mm-hmm. Ford Mustang is really selling well, but by and large, their cars are not that exciting.
Now, we've heard about the huge financier, Kurt Kerkorian, talking about coming in, spending almost $1 billion to buy GM stock. What does he see that these announcements today wouldn't necessarily lead the rest of us to see here?
Well, it's hard to say exactly what he sees because he's not talking, but if you look at GM, their market value is roughly, the other day, was about $15 billion, but they have $20 billion in cash. So you can make an argument that the company is well undervalued at the current stock price, and I suspect Mr. Kerkorian looks at GM and says that if somebody comes in and does a real restructuring, that it could be worth a whole lot more than it is now. GM also does have a very profitable financing arm. Most people know it by the name GMAC,
mm-hmm.
and that makes a lot of money. And if you broke up the company, potentially, that's a very hypothetical idea, you might be able to get more than the current stock price. So I think that's what Krikorian is looking at.
And there in Detroit, a final question, Neil. When the wise guys there look down the road, they see all the challenges around these companies, lots of hurdles, but yet most people think that they won't go away. What do Ford and GM look like 10 years from now?
That's hard to say, and it depends on how much nerve the management teams at each company has. It will take some really steely nerves to push through the kind of restructuring that both companies need. Potentially, you know, on one end, they could be much smaller companies than they are now, possibly profitable. In the auto industry, nobody really collapses and disappears the way Enron did. If you look at, there are other car companies around that have hung on for decades in bad state. So it's possible they could limp along for many years to come.
Well, we've seen, though, in the U.K. what can happen to big names, and they can get awfully small after a while. Neil, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Pleasure to talk with you.
Neil Baudette, Deputy Detroit Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal. He spoke with me from Detroit. Anne Lamott loves Jesus, but is not so sure about George W. Bush. She struggles every day to make sense of the world, and she shares that struggle in her columns and books. Everyone has been having a hard time with life this year, she writes. Not with all of it, just the waking hours. Add terrorism and the Iraq War to the death of her mother, turning 50, and butting heads with a teenage son, and Lamott could be forgiven for throwing up her hands. But this is Anne Lamott. As her longtime readers know from the last tale of her spiritual journey, Traveling Mercies, this single white mother with dreadlocks who fought alcoholism and found God as a progressive Christian is not about to surrender. Her new collection of essays makes that doubly clear as she connects the dots between grace and forgiveness, winning a free ham in a supermarket, starting a Sunday school, and raging against the machine. Lamott may not have the right personality for the human condition, as she puts it, but she has a knack for honing in on the conditions that make us human and maybe something more. Tonight on Point, Anne Lamott and Plan B. You can join the conversation. Are you an Anne Lamott acolyte? Have you followed her journey from alcohol to God to faith still colored with fury? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from San Francisco is Anne Lamott. Her new book is Plan B, Further Thoughts on Faith. Lamott is the best-selling author of 6 novels and 3 other nonfiction books, including Operating Instructions, which chronicled the first year of her son's life. She writes a column for Salon.com called Word by Word. She received a Guggenheim Fellowship and was the subject of a 1999 documentary by Academy Award-winning filmmaker Freda Mock. Anne Lamott, thanks a lot for being with us tonight.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here. I love WBUR.
Oh, well, thank you. Thanks. It's great to have you with us. You've got your new book, Plan B, and you've been out on the road talking about it. And you've been out talking about it in a particular time when religion is so much in the headlines and so much in the news. What kind of reception, what kind of questions has that left you getting in?
Well, I'll answer that. But first, I just want to say in your introduction, you said I'm a hellraiser. And actually, I'm just sort of a run-of-the-mill left-wing activist. You know, I'm just a kind of an aging hippie Birkenstock anti-George Bush activist. I get jailed protesting the war and stuff like that, but Hellraiser makes it sound like I have a lot more energy than I do. But
well, I've got to say, anyway, your prose still have a pretty good kick to them, Anne.
It's pretty edgy, yeah.
You still manage to make the page stand up pretty well. I'd call it a kind of Hellraising, even if it's not, burning down the barn.
Oh, thank you. Well, I think it's true that in Traveling Mercies, which is the same sort of collection of pieces on faith and in everyday life, I think the difference is that Clinton was president and I was in a much better mood. So I think that there is a sort of edginess to some of the most of the pieces, let's say. But the kind of questions I got were had to do with how do I reconcile my faith as a left-wing Christian with the faith of the Republicans and the far right? And it was the people kept using the word reconcile, and it was funny because I definitely believe in the reconciliation of all people, and that we can that we're one family and that we're brothers and sisters, but I can't reconcile myself to anything that the White House believes or puts forth because I think they've just got it so wrong. Like, I read a little bit of Bible every day, and I can't find the part in the New Testament where it talks about, like, arming everybody or how what a good idea Jesus thinks it would be if you just took some of the angriest people on earth and gave them weapons. Or you can't find anything in the New Testament about tax cuts. So I can't position myself in relationship to their faith because I have a very, very different understanding of what I'm called upon to do, which is to take care of the poor and when people are thirsty to get them water and to help feed them and to give them hope. So I think George Bush has really given a lot of hope to Wall Street and to the stock and bond traders, but I don't think to working men and women in America.
And you carry that torch with anger, also with humor. Right off the bat in your book, you say, on my 49th birthday, I decided that all of life was hopeless and I would eat myself to death.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
But there wasn't any food in the house. And also my back was out and I didn't want to die in crone mode.
In crone mode. Anne Lamott, we're delighted to have you with us tonight. There's a lot more we want to hear. You're coming in from an interesting angle and it's great to have you with us. Listeners, you can join the conversation tonight. Are you an Anne Lamott acolyte? Have you joined her on her journey from alcohol to God to faith and still that fury? And do you relate to her bumpy, candid, even profane relationship with faith, with Christianity? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Anne Lamott's new book is Plan B, Further Thoughts on Faith. You can join us, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with best-selling Christian novelist and essayist Anne Lamott about Jesus, George Bush, and her unorthodox take on life, faith, and family. You can join us tonight. What's your question for humorist, iconoclast, seeker, believer, Anne Lamott? And is America still big enough for all kinds of believers, from James Dobson to Anne Lamott? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. She's had a bunch of bestsellers out there. They get tremendously loyal kind of following. Go on Amazon.com. You'll hear people saying, this is the only book that truly changed my life. And what about that following? Who do you find in it when you look around?
Oh, I don't know. I guess I don't look around very much, but when I'm
but they're back there,
my,
you know it.
Well, when I'm doing a reading or something, I notice then that the people that seem to like my work are or that do like my work tend to be very, very literary. We've all read the same books. We all love the same writers. We all love Nick Hornby, and we all love Barbara Kingsolver, and we all read a lot of poetry. And they're people that tend to like to laugh, and there's a line in Plan B that laughter is carbonated holiness, and I think probably that's something you don't get in a lot of other writers on you don't get quite so much of in other books by spiritual writers. I love, by the way, that I'm the other end of the spectrum than from James Dobson, which I'd say pretty much captures it. A lot of people that like my work ran screaming for their cute little lives when they got out of their parents' house because they'd been so beaten down or browbeaten or shamed by their parents' religion, and they didn't actually believe that they could feel included in a faith community, whether it's Christian or Buddhist or whether they're Jews or agnostics, but that they never believed that there would be a spiritual home for them. And I know that for everyone there is. I don't really think that Jesus is the place where most people will or should try to end up. It's how I actually found my church and a pretty disorganized, organized religion, a very, very integrated church in a year before I got sober. So it's a different order than I got sober and then found God. I went to church drunk and hungover for a year, and I've been there for 19 sober years and 1 year where people didn't quite know what to make of me.
And, you know, we'll have a lot of listeners who have read a lot of your work and know all about your life, and others who just won't know a thing about it. I wish you'd be generous enough to share a little biography with us. Where did you come from that you found yourself kind of strung out, hungover, an alcoholic, needing that redemption? How did you find yourself at that door? How did it all unfold?
Well, I was raised in the same county I live in now, which is Marin County, California, which is in the north of San Francisco, and on the other side of the Golden Gate Bridge. And I was raised by people who never had enough money but were sort of lower upper middle class. My father was a writer, and we were very cultured, and my parents worshipped at the Miles Davis Holiness Temple and really, really loved jazz and folk music, and were very left-wing. My father was a part of the avant-garde literary movement in San Francisco that included the beatniks and the beat poets, and
I'm reading here that when there were executions scheduled at Alcatraz, he would take you along to vigils.
When there were executions at San Quentin.
San Quentin, excuse me.
Because, he had taught English there in the 50s and 60s to the prisoners and written quite a lot about it. One of his books is a biography of San Quentin. And, I was just raised to be the way I am, except for the Jesus-y part. But I was raised in a family of activists. My parents were left-wing. My parents were actually Democratic precinct leaders, which is sort of what I am, but a little bit farther to the left. In fact, in operating instructions, I said I was going to raise Sam to be the leader of the rebel forces because the first George Bush, George Herbert Walker, sushi barfing Bush, was president. So I wrote this sort of anti-George Bush baby book about 12 years ago. But anyway, now I've come to feel that I just want to raise him to be a Democratic precinct leader. I come by this naturally. And I was a very high achiever. I was a really excellent tennis player and a good student. And I had all sorts of things that you would think or the world would tell you would fill in the Swiss cheesy parts of you. But I just felt very stressed and confused and overwhelmed a lot. I was an extremely sensitive child and teenager. I have what psychiatrists call clinical sensitivity, or at least my psychiatrist friend said that's what I have. And I discovered drinking really early on. And like most good alcoholics, as soon as I understood how much prettier it made me feel and how much more inhabitable my insides became after a couple of, social drinks, like maybe five or six quick social drinks, I just knew that was what I was going to be doing. And so I just drank a lot. I wrote a lot. I got a number of books published. And again, it was stuff that you would think meant that the world had validated your parking ticket and that you'd feel like you belonged and that you were more or less okay. But I never felt that. And the easy way to explain it is the thing about how we have a God-shaped hole inside of us. And I would use God to mean good orderly direction or goodness or, in the case of being in recovery, a group of drunks helping you. But I just had that hole, and I was bulimic. I had every single disorder you can have except for gambling. I don't have a gambling disorder, but I used to get overstimulated when I was getting change at the laundromats, and I put in too many dollar bills because the quarters would come out. But I had food. I had every single disorder you could have, and I was living on a little tiny houseboat, really tiny, on in Sausalito, which some of your listeners will probably know of, and it was right across the street from Marin City, which is a ghetto of, it's not a ghetto, I mean it is kind of, but it's where the extremely poor people of Marin County live, where the shipbuilders came from the south during World War II to be a part of the Army-Navy shipbuilding efforts, and it's mostly black. There's 2,200 people, and there's six churches, so there's a lot going on there.
The poor sliver of a very rich county.
Yeah, there's only like two very poor areas. Mm-hmm. One is the canal area of San Rafael, where mostly Hispanic people live. So
you walked by a church and were drawn in.
Well, I used to go over to the flea market that used to be there. And when I'm hungover, I like really slippery, nice food. And I go over to get the slippery, nice food and maybe do a little retail therapy, although it wasn't retail. And I used to hear this music wafting over from this church, St. Andrew. And it was a lot of it was gospel, which I love. And a lot of it was the songs that I grew up hearing that were sung by Joan Baez or the Weavers that were really the soundtrack of the civil rights movement. And little by little, it was like in those cartoons where somebody's got a cherry pie cooling on the windowsill and the delicious aroma makes a snaky finger of deliciousness, and it goes in into the living room where the man is sleeping watching the TV, and it thumps him on his chest.
It pulls him up.
And he wakes up and follows it and gets to the pie and eats it accidentally. Well, that was what the music was like for me. And I used to go there and just sit there, and they never hassled me. They never tried to welcome me in a way that I associate with Christians, which is too enthusiastic. They never tried to hug me or sign up for Bible study or try to help them figure out who shot the Holy Ghost. They just let me be.
And it filled that emptiness, you say. You said you're alive because of your conversion. And I wanted to ask you.
I think I am, yeah.
Well, you said that you had grandparents who were Presbyterian missionaries in Japan. Uh-huh. You say that you do feel a missionary zeal, and then this interesting phrase, not to convert, but to break through a sense of shame about God. What do you mean by that, Anne Lamott?
Well, I mean that most of the people I know, certainly everyone I'm close to, feels a lot of the sort of equal proportions of grandiosity and then terrible self-esteem. And so it's makes it very complicated when you're trying to believe that you're part of something when out of the right-hand speaker on the radio station is coming this stream of what a mess you are, or what a fraud, or how you've hurt everybody again, or let people down, or let yourself down, or you know, you're about to be exposed. And out of the left-hand speaker comes that you're special, you're different than, you're more sensitive, you're smarter than.
This is the internal conversation.
The eternal conversation, and it goes, you know, it's in your damaged mind. Most of the people worth getting really close to are people like me who felt very frightened and not part of when they were children. And so there gets to be such a shame about who you are essentially. And so what I like to do is to just talk to people about what it's like for me, and to, like with operating instructions, I couldn't find any books that spoke to me about mothering, because
this is first year of the life of your son,
Sam. When I had Sam, the books on mothering were all just such Pollyanna-ish books about how if the baby had colic, which Sam did, babies almost always respond to these soft Sierra Club music, I mean tapes of nature sounds. Well, in our case, they just terrified Sam, I think. It was like the bugs are coming, you know, the
mountain
aphids
lions,
are here.
Right.
The mountain lions are here, so nothing really worked. And for me, what has worked in the world is people just telling the truth and helping me just take a long, deep breath and hear that we're much more alike one another than we are different. Mm. And people have helped me get my sense of humor back. And so when I used to teach writing, I always told my students to write the books that they'd love to come upon. And so that's what I've tried to do is with operating instructions of the book on writing, which is Bird by Bird, to just write a book that you would like to come upon, because it's not promising you that you're going to get published or that you're always going to be a wonderful parent and feel like Marmee and Little Women, but that says, oh, yeah, me too, which I think is a great message of Jesus is, oh, yeah, me too. I know. I got it. And then somehow you get your sense of humor back, and then you get your buoyancy back, and you can kind of be playful again, and then you're home.
Anne Lamott, take that long, deep breath. We've got a mountain of callers who want to join this conversation, and I want to begin to welcome them in, if we may. Anne Lamott's with us tonight, best-selling author. Her newest book is Plan B, Further Thoughts on Faith. Susan is calling from Fort Washington, Wisconsin. Hi, Susan. You're on the air.
Hi. I am so thrilled to talk to Anne. I am in the middle of reading your book, Anne. I read it every morning, and then I journal after I read it. And the most amazing thing is that I had read your previous books, like Bird by Bird, and I recently got a book contract for a book that I'm
fantastic.
Writing.
Oh, fantastic. Good.
And unfortunately, I'm writing a business book, which is much more right-wing than you are, but I really relate to all the things you say I may like George Bush a little more than you do.
That's
but
probable.
But I'm also on the other liberal side of things and live in Chicago. So, you know, I can't be too Republican. And I just adore and find you to be so inspiring. I don't really have a question for you.
Oh, well,
other than how's Sam doing?
Yeah, well, mazel tov and blessing on your book. And it's not just a business book. It's your first contract, you know, and anything could happen. And this book is probably going to be like doing scales, you know, for something that might be more from your heart or from your history or something down the road. So just think of it as scales. It's like, you know, like with writing or with playing music, you don't start out wanting to play Farmer in the Dell or something, you know, and then botch your favorite Beatles song. You want to play Chopin. So this is how we all of us get to it. But
well,
Sam's
your
great.
Inspiration. You're insane. You helped me so.
Yes, Susan, we've got it. And we hear your fervor for Anne Lamott. We appreciate your call. Let's get another caller. Tom is calling from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
How are you all doing tonight?
Great, thanks. What's on your mind, Tom?
I'm calling because I'm a Presbyterian minister. I'm a Presbyterian PK and have kind of been in and out of the church professionally. And now I'm in a church as a sort of head of staff, and have been there in a while helping the church try to figure out what its central purpose is.
Do you read Anne Lamott, Tom?
I do, and have for quite some time, and enjoy it. And actually, a humorous story, when I first came, when I was candidating for this church, I had a quote in my sermon from Anne Lamott, I can't remember which, I think it was something about Traveling Mercies.
Yeah.
And afterwards, one of the members came and said, "You got to be careful of who you quote from the pulpit." So I don't know. That's probably
getting off the reservation there. So what's your question for Ann, Tom? You've got her ear tonight.
Yeah, my question is, I'm really seeking advice. One of the things that has struck me all along in my role as a minister working with people is to help them discover their own faith. And for me, that's a faith centered in grace. And knowing you're loved and there's possibilities. And that sort of in response, I guess I'd call that discipleship. You discover God, you hear that call, and you find a way to live that out. And in my work, I find a great resistance and a great fear upon people to even go there, to really take on a bold life that is somehow uniquely their own. They want to be guided. They want me to tell them what to do, and I'm just looking for what advice. I appreciate your comment a minute ago about truth and living truthfully and so forth. But I'm wondering if you just have any
advice for a Presbyterian minister in Albuquerque who wants to break through. Anne, what do you say?
Well, my pastor, Veronica, tells this story that I just love of this little kid that she knew that whose grandfather was the minister of their church. And one day she heard the girl saying to one of her friends who had asked, what does your grandfather do? The little girl said, "Well, he comes to church every single Sunday and he tells everyone, God loves you. God really, really loves you and cares for you." And then they all get really, really happy and they sing and they are very kind to one another. But then in the next days or so, they all forget that. So he comes back every single Sunday and he says, "God really loves you and cares for you and is really pulling for you." And so that's sort of what the purpose for me is that I you know, there's. I think it's a bumper sticker. It's not anything esoteric, but it says God loves you exactly the way you are, and she loves you too much to let you stay like this. So I think that certainly in our church school, we concentrate on the first part of that God loves you exactly the way you are, and whatever you've done, however terrible your thoughts are, no matter what you secretly think about yourself or others, you're welcome here exactly the way you are. It's a come as you are party. And I think also for me, it's been very, very important for pastors and spiritual advisors to help me just have a sense of safety and sort of quiet sanctuary where I can bear not having answers to the tough questions and kind of bear the mystery of faith that were, you know, for thousands of years, the great writers and the poets and the songwriters have written about it, the fact that it's a mystery. You're just not going to know. And you know, when I was on tour and I'd get a lot of calls from people from the Christian right, they would tell me how far short I fell of God's plans for me, since I'm passionate about women's rights, abortion rights, gay rights. And I always just say, you can tell you've created God in your own image when he or she hates the exact same people you do. So the two things I would advise are to just sort of help create a sense of safety and lack of judgment so that people can bear the entering into the mystery of faith and of spirit, and just barely long enough to find that there's something deep, deep, deep inside of them that really isn't ruined and that hasn't been forced to conform, that can hear. It's like there's a great Christian line, and I don't know where this is from, that says that the soul rejoices in hearing what it already knows. So there's something inside of us that rejoices and sits up when you say something authentic. So hope that helps.
So there it is. Tom in Albuquerque, good luck. Anne Lamott, stick with us. We've got to take a short break here. We're talking tonight with best-selling novelist and essayist Anne Lamott. Her new book is Plan B, Further Thoughts on Faith. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with best-selling novelist and essayist Anne Lamott about Jesus, George Bush, and her unorthodox take on life, faith, and family. Her new book is Plan B, Further Thoughts on Faith. You can join us tonight. Is America still big enough for all kinds of believers? From James Dobson to Anne Lamott, are you drawn to Anne Lamott's untidy faith, her unvarnished politics, or are you put off? Is this a voice that speaks for you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And there's so much humor in the new book, Plan B. I wish you'd read just a little bit for us. You talk a lot in here about age. You're turning 51 next month, I think.
No, I turned 51 last month.
I'm behind. Well, happy birthday then.
Thank you. I'm a big girl now. Yeah. I'm wearing my big girl pants.
Yeah, with your, what do you call those 50-year-old thighs? You're pretty rough on them, but affectionate too, the aunties.
Very affectionate. I'm very affectionate. And there's a lot in this book about the most militant act you can do is to refuse to wear pants that aren't comfortable anymore right. And to refuse to let your pants have an opinion on how you're doing in the world.
Exactly.
But anyway, this is actually an untitled piece that is. I'll just read you about a page or so.
Great.
Okay. I was at a wedding the other day with a lot of women in their 20s and 30s. Many wore sexy dresses, their youthful skin aglow. And even though I was 20 to 30 years older than they, a little worse for wear, a little tired and overwhelmed by the loud music, I was smiling. I smiled with a secret smile of pleasure in being older, 50 plus change, which can no longer be considered extremely late youth or even early middle age, but I would not give back a year of life I've lived. Age has given me what I was looking for my entire life. It has given me me. It has provided time and experience and failures and triumphs and time-tested friends who have helped me step into the shape that was waiting for me. I fit into me now. I have an organic life, finally, not necessarily the one people imagined for me or tried to get me to have. I have the life I longed for. I have become the woman I hardly dared imagine I could be. There are parts I don't love. Until a few years ago, I had no idea that you could actually get cellulite on your stomach. But not only do I get along with me most of the time now, I am militantly and maternally on my own side. Left to my own devices, would I trade this for firm thighs, fewer wrinkles, and a better memory? You bet I would. That's why it's such a blessing that I'm not left to my own devices. I have amazing friends, a church, I have a cool kid, a sweet boyfriend, and darling pets. I've learned to pay attention to life and to listen. I'd give all this up for a flatter belly, only about a third of the time.
Anne Lamott reading from her new book, Plan B. Stephanie's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Stephanie. You're on the air.
Hi. Boy, this is a pleasure to talk to Anne Lamott. I am a huge fan of yours, and I hope that you have a lot of your books on tape because one of the things I've lost is my ability to read. I can still see that part of my vision has gotten worse. But you know something? I would describe Anne as real. Say unvarnished or unorthodox. Mm. you're so real, and I love the way. I really relate to you. I feel like you know you're. But what I wanted to really say is, and I'm struggling with this as a person of faith, is really trying my best not to hate the president. I really don't want. I want to be real. I don't want to be a phony, and I love to read. I love books. I do love public radio and progressive talk radio. And I'll tell you, I'm very disturbed at how I found myself becoming in terms of the way I would talk about the, you know, hearing people talk about the president, the names they call him, and the hate that, you know, I mean, people talk about not drinking the right-wing Kool-Aid. Well, we can't drink the left-wing Kool-Aid either. We can't, you know, we've got to somehow, in order for us to come together, the James Dobsons and the Ann Lamotts and Tom and you and me and all of us to be able to have a common place.
Amen.
You know,
And yet you say you feel this kind of an emotion, even a hatred, that you don't want to feel. So what do you do with
it? Exactly.
Well, I can tell you what I did with it. And also the book is on tape. And if you leave your name and address with somebody who took your call, if there's any way to do that, I'll send you one. It's on CDs. But and there's a lot. There's a piece on it called "Loving Your President Day 2." There's a couple of pieces on just how tormenting it is to have had such really terrible, terrible feelings. I'd use the word hate, although if somebody from the right accused me of it, I wouldn't. But
Ann, I must say, the Los Angeles Times says, for example, you make it sound as if you're living in Berlin during the rise of Hitler.
Yeah, I actually think we are. I would agree with that. And actually, that was an extremely hostile, stupid piece in the L.A. Times, but it wasn't the review, which was glowing. It was a feature by somebody who was very antagonistic to me.
But they caught your sense of antagonism toward the president. And Stephanie's asking this question: How do we pull together here? How do you deal with that kind of feeling?
Yeah, I was going to explain. Mm-hmm. Let me tell you what I have experienced. In the piece called "Loving Your President Day 2," I had the kind of breakthrough that you're talking about, where you. I had it in church, though, unfortunately, because they always make you leave eventually on a Sunday. And it was about loving everyone. And it was about how everyone's your brother and sister, and that Jesus doesn't say, like, try to love everyone or try to forgive. Do the best you can. It's very clear. It's a mandate. And so I had that breakthrough where I could just see him as a little kid, and I could see the struggles and the failure, and I felt like the most subversive thing I could do would be to begin to love him in the spiritual sense of that, like not want to have him over for lunch. And I got somewhere with it, and the next day I unfortunately turned on the news, and I was sort of back, not quite where I started, because that's what grace means to me, is that it meets you right where you are, and then it doesn't drop you off where you were. It takes you someplace you couldn't have gotten to by yourself, and I was ever so slightly better. And what happened was, at our church, we have something that's kind of an altar call, but they just call it opening the church doors. And it's for people who are really struggling. When you're really a mess, physically or psychologically or mentally, you can go get the prayers of the people. And sometimes no one goes up. But about every 3 weeks, I would go up and say to my pastor before the congregation, I'd say, I am so troubled and feeling so mentally ill because of my feelings of hostility towards the president and the administration that it's wrecking. It's just wrecking all my sense of peace and justice and goodness that are also a part of me, you know, and there's just so much hate marbled in. And she never judged me. She never said, oh, for God's sake, Annie, well, then you're not a good Christian. She'd say, oh, honey, it's really hard. And it's just, and she'd say, if you just show up, it's like 80% of the solution. And all I can say is I did it for about a year and a half, and I don't have to go up there anymore, because it's like the water of the pond settled a little bit, and the election was tough, and I felt pretty hopeless and flattened. I felt like this dental x-ray apron was pressing down on me when I woke up in the mornings. But what happened was that I started to realize I wasn't where I was, and I'm not full of so much hate. I can't stand this presidency, and part of what I'm saying, I guess, is that I'm a lot better. I'm less hysterical, and on the other hand, I'm never going to get anywhere with this president.
But Ann, let me ask you, if I may, on that. Yeah. You know, there are millions of Americans who line up with George Bush. Many of them are avowed Christians. In that spirit of reaching out, of bridging, of love, can you feel their fear or their hope? What takes them to this support? I mean, these are not aliens from another planet. These are fellow human beings, fellow Americans.
Yeah. A lot of Republicans come to my events, although I am not sure why, but because I'm very obviously a bleeding heart liberal. But people come up to me, and sometimes they'll do this kind of assault scripture at me, and it's kind of like a drive-by assault scripture. But mostly they say, you know, what I love about you is the part beyond our differences, where we're just so human and we're so loved by God. And then one of them said to me, actually it was in Boston, funnily enough, if there is such a word, said, I hate the way that you write about the Christian right, though. And I said, but I hate the way you're running this country. I believe that the Christian right in the White House is destroying the earth, and we have to fight back. I want to be a grandmother. And I also, we held hands, and we were kind to each other, and we looked into each other's eyes, and we saw where we are beyond the differences. But at the same time, I'm going to go to my grave fighting for the poor, and I'm going to go to my grave fighting for women's rights and for the rights of gays and for, you know, for social justice issues in this country and for the environment. So I can only tell my truth. Look, they've got the White House, both houses of the Congress, and they've got every single thing they could ever want, and they won by 3 million votes. We almost won, and it's not like they're being squelched. Like everything you listen to or see, so much of it is about that party line, and it seems like propaganda to me, because they are destroying the environment. The Clean Air Act made it legal to have a great deal more pollutants in the air, and so on. And so, you know, you've got National Public Radio, and you've got Air America, and mostly the media is run by or is either more conservative or it's neutral. But there's very, very little that is in the media that has to do with the faith of a great many American believers. And I think that there are just about as many American believers in a benevolent intelligence caring for us as there are fundamentalist Christians. They're just a lot better media coverage, because they've spiritualized their hysteria. So you get this Terry Schiavo thing, or you get Tom DeLay, and it just makes for much more interesting media coverage than us with our little placards.
And yet I'm with Stephanie in wanting to keep the tent open to the whole population, the whole conversation. I mean, ultimately, you've got to have a conversation that arcs right over this whole thing. What about your friends, Anne, who aren't into faith at all? Do they look at you and think you've gone off the deep end?
I think so. Well, most of my friends are not Christians. A lot of them are sober alcoholics who have a spirituality and a belief in God as they really understand God in the deepest, truest, most real and undamaged parts of themselves. And I love the people at my church, and they're my brother, sister, family, but I don't socialize much at all. I'm very odd socially. A lot of my friends, all of them, I would say, are left-wing intellectuals. And I think this is seen, the Jesus thing, as it's called, is seen as my little blind spot. Same within my family. We mostly try to gloss over it.
Anne, thanks for being with us tonight. It's wonderful talking with you. Thanks for your time.
It's wonderful talking with you, Tom. Thank you.
Best to your growing up son, Sam.
Thank you.
Anne Lamott, author of Plan B, Further Thoughts on Faith. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, the education of a rookie mom. This is On Point. Sunday is Mother's Day, a day to honor the women who brought us into the world, who comforted us at 3 a.m. as infants, and who let us borrow the car as teenagers. Beth Title knows the challenges of motherhood well. The Boston Herald humor columnist has two young sons, aged 3 and 4. She captures the ups and downs and absurdities of motherhood in her new book, From Here to Maternity, The Education of a Rookie Mom. Tonight, Beth Title reads a passage from her book and shares her secret for surviving the tribulations of motherhood.
Motherhood is great, but as we all know, particularly because it's been getting so much attention lately, there's a lot of stress involved with the job. One of my friends described it as the toughest job you'll ever love. That was when I was about a couple of weeks away from my due date, and an allusion to the Marines wasn't really what I wanted to hear at that point. But it is, you know, 30% of new moms suffer from postpartum depression because it can be really hard. I mean, one day I myself was struggling with my two kids, and my husband wasn't around to talk to, my friends weren't around, and I actually called the parental stress line kind of crying, and she said, she was asking me questions about myself. She said, do you work? And I said, I do. And she said, what are you doing? And I said, I'm writing a lighthearted book about motherhood. And really, the only way that I have found to get through the harder parts of it is by using humor. I tell this to a lot of new moms. Pretend that you are a character in a sitcom. It makes things a lot easier to deal with. I mean, what is more like an episode of Seinfeld, actually, than doing what I call mommy dating? That's basically when you and your smaller half go on a play date with another woman and her smaller half. And, you know, of course, it's supposed to be all about the children. But the moms are sitting there thinking, does she like me? Does she like what I'm wearing? Is she just not that into me? In my book, I actually give what I call the rules for mommy dating. It should be all about the kids. Make sure you're not going to get dumped by the other woman. Now I'm going to read a passage from my book, From Here to Maternity, The Education of a Rookie Mom. Here's one thing every woman knows. A good man is hard to find. But here's one thing every mom knows. A good babysitter is also really hard to find. And I have to say, as a mother, it drives you to just crazy extremes. I'm always looking for babysitters. I've sort of turned into a pickup artist. And I'm thinking about this day that I was at gymnastics with my children at the YMCA. And yes, I should have been focusing on my older son's tumbling feats, but really, I couldn't take my eyes off the teacher. Peppy, wholesome, creative. Mommy, look at me, my son, I think, yelled from the mini-tramp. I'd been daydreaming about the instructor. You're great, I called out to my boy, giving him a thumbs up. I decided to go for it with the instructor. What are you doing after work? She knew what I was after, despite my clumsiness. Sorry, she said, but we're not allowed to accept babysitting jobs from people we meet here. Motherhood had turned me into a pickup artist, always on the prowl for sweet young things to watch my sweet young things. The supermarket cashier who chuckled when my kids disabled the credit card machine? Can she do Friday nights? The waitress who brought extra crayons and straws, stat? I'll give her the biggest tip she's ever seen. And then there was the co-ed I stopped on the street. Her college sweatshirt carried the name of a school known for its early education program. What a turn-on. In retrospect, I realized that the gymnastics teacher's no meant no. But at the time, I thought she was like one of those sources I encounter as a journalist, eager to talk but afraid someone's watching. Stamp your foot twice if you're interested, I whispered as we locked eyes over the balance beam. My number's in the book. Like a schoolgirl with a crush, I sat by the phone. But gymnastics rolled around again with no word. In class, co-spotting my kid on the uneven bars, neither of us mentioned last week's come on. Driving home, I was wondering what I'd done wrong. Was I not enthusiastic enough about my son's back somersault? When my car was rear-ended at a red light, jolted out of my shame spiral, I jumped out of the vehicle to talk to the other driver. It was a young woman. I'm so sorry, she said. I don't know what happened. I wasn't even on my cell phone. She wrote down her license and registration, but I wanted a different number. Her cell. She looked like babysitting material. She seems really nice, I told my husband later. She doesn't have to chauffeur the kids around.
Beth Title is a columnist with the Boston Herald. Her new book is titled From Here to Maternity, The Education of a Rookie Mom. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.